You're listening to the Sketchnote Army Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Rohde, the author of the Sketchnote Handbook and the Sketchnote Workbook, and this is the podcast where I chat with sketchnoters and visual thinkers and try to understand what makes them tick. Hey everyone, it's Mike, and I'm here with Franziska Swartz. Welcome, Franziska. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you. So let's get started. Tell us who you are and what you do, and then if you like, jump right into your origin story. As regular listeners will know, this is sort of the meat and the heart of the discussion.
Yes, thanks, Mike. I will do that. I'm actually a science communicator. I have a scientific background. I studied nutrition in Potsdam, which is close to Berlin, and got a PhD in nutrition and medicine. And I had a big problem actually in my last PhD year because I always fell asleep in these lab seminars, which was kind of sad. Gladly now I'm really a graphic recorder, primarily in science, doing illustrations and graphic recordings. But really, whenever I fell asleep in these seminars, I could have never imagined myself being here now, because I only needed a solution, a small one. Because in these seminars, as longer you're there, to the end of your PhD, you have to ask these smart questions. And well, my questions didn't get smarter because I could never keep up with all these students having their talks. And at least after the third, maybe bar chart, I was gone. So I really needed a solution to take better notes. And that was in 2015. So I kind of Googled and looked for something like better note-taking. Mm-hmm. And I think after an hour, I came around some weird guy who wrote a book called Sketchnotes. And it was the only one on the market. There was another kind of little booklet called Bicablo.
And of course.
Like, okay, that's it. And I saw some images online in the image search. So I figured it kind of looks fun, and I really had nothing to go with. So it was just like, okay, I'm ordering this. And I at first, because I thought it was manageable, I didn't really look on the website or anything. I said Bicablo, and I just copied all these icons, and it worked. And there was no community that I knew. And I just, for half a year, I was practicing. I read your books like in 2 days. I was with a good friend and on holiday. We were doing a spa day. And the whole day I just sat in the spa on on the couch and was just like, oh, that's cool. I can do that. I can just try it. And I tried implementing it in my daily life in the lab. And from there on, over half a year, it spread. It was like infecting everything. And I was the only one doing it. People wanted to sit beside me in the lab seminar because they were watching me draw.
So first of all,
they thought I was doodling. I'm just like, no. I'm kind of taking notes. And it just enriched my daily life so much. But I was still alone for a really long time. Mm-hmm. Nobody knew it. I mean, I was in Berlin. In Berlin, everyone knows that. But I was in my science bubble. So in the science bubble, there was nothing. There was no one. Everybody thought, she's doodling. Okay, she's asking smart questions. Let her do this. She's there. She's awake. And there was one big convention in Berlin once, after maybe a year of my first contact with these notes. Where there was actually a big pharmaceutical company, and they asked me if they could take a picture of my notes because they wanted to put it on Twitter. I was not on Twitter by that time. Actually, they wanted to buy my book, and I was just like, why do you want to buy my sketchbook? I mean, they're my notes. Yeah. Why? Because it looks so nice. We want to have this. It's like, yes, my notes. Why? Why money for that? I mean, I was a scientist back then. It was why do you not like me for the work I'm doing, for the research? Why do you want... I didn't get it. So, but over time, there were all these, exactly these situations where people outside of this really deep science community of the lab rats, they were trying to give me money for these notes. And that kind of crushed the concept that I was living before. I was like, okay. And I looked actually in Berlin for people. that are doing something like this. And I found the Whistling Group. Mm-hmm. And the Whistling Group, it was December. It was dark. It was in somewhere in Berlin where I've never been before. And there was this hub. Back then, I didn't even know what a hub was. So this sheltered life that I was living behind a microscope kind of collapsed with creative people. And there was Benjamin Fellis from Berlin.
Of course, yeah.
And Nadine even was there too. And They were all kind of drawing and talking about pens. So it was okay. And they had sketchbooks with them. That was okay too. And Benjamin was drawing some kind of universe on the wall and had cut out asteroids and rockets. And this whole time was standing there, and I told them, you know, you'd want to do something like a yearly review, but I wasn't there. And they said, it's okay. Just be there, have fun. And I texted my boyfriend at that time and was like, honey, I have no clue what I'm doing here. I have no clue what they're doing, but this is cool. I'm staying. And from that moment on, I connected with the Berlin crowd and took workshops. And at a certain point, they told me, you know, exactly what you were doing in science and with what you did so far. When we see your sketchbooks, you are a graphic recorder. Mm-hmm. So, and after I finished the workshop, they said, you know, we cannot teach you anymore.
You're already beyond our teaching.
You are done. You know what you do, and all the stuff, the specific stuff, is the science part. And we usually do not take these jobs because we don't understand the scientists.
Right, right.
So why don't you do that for a living? And the coincidence took it that at the time I had like 1 year left in my old job, And we have a system in Germany when you are actually in the science field. You can only stay employed at the university or somewhere similar for 12 years. Then you have to leave. So there was a clock ticking anyways. And I had already sent out application to pharmaceutical companies. I wanted actually to teach at the university, but my research was not good enough. It's just collecting points from your publications. And I didn't really want to do research. I loved teaching back then. I taught medical students at the Charité in Berlin. It was fun. Me and the flip chart, we were one. We already knew each other. I was allowed to... I actually played Dr. House with my students. We were encouraged as teachers to really draw on paper and to draw our cases out. And the students were similar to us just in what they liked. So it was a lot of fun. But I couldn't do this for a living. I was always rejected. I was too much of a scientist to teach. And so I just went for the chance of either being employed at a pharmaceutical company or because someone told me that, why don't you just get help at your university? And they have a transfer service. That's what's called there. And they pick up these weird startup ideas. And I just went there with a sketchbook. And I was just like, hi, I'm doing something people want to give me money for, but I'm a scientist. I didn't go to university for illustration or anything, but people want to give me money for that, and I don't understand that. And it seems like I'm even with a PhD in nutritional medicine, I'm not good enough for the job market for some strange reason. And you're one of my straws that I have. And they looked at me, and they looked at my sketchbook, and I saw these stars in their eyes, sparking. And they were just like, come, just close the door behind you. We have to talk. And for this last year that I was in my job, they actually, I took a training with them. They said, we will teach you everything, and then you can decide if you want to do this for a job. We won't push you. So I kind of... I had all the time in the world. My boss at the Charité was really understanding. He saw that I'm not getting anywhere, that I have to get out. He was still surprised when I left. But he couldn't offer me another position. So I had to leave. And I just said, you know, this last year, I could finish all the projects that I have. And I even drew some stuff for my colleagues because they let me just then, as soon as they knew there's something that I could do. And I bought the first iPad then. The first iPad Pro came out, because before that, I could have never done some kind of graphic stuff or just the Photoshop and Illustrator. We are not friends. So there were these drawing apps, and I remember trying out Paper 53 for the first time. And I always wrote my thoughts, and I just tried something out and brushes and wrote everything on there. And like 3 hours later, somebody was talking to me. It was my boyfriend. It's like, what you doing there? Where do you come from?
What time is it?
Suddenly, it's like, what happened here? So I was able to illustrate my own PowerPoint slides and even my own publication. And I had permission to do that for other groups too. And suddenly, I was one of the most favored persons, actually, in the house.
I bet.
And that's then the last year I noticed how much really these scientists needed good visuals. That there's some kind of lag. And that helped me on the other part with the university, where they were teaching me to find this USP, to do everything for the papers, to make them happy, to define what my future job could be. And that was 5 years ago.
So I guess it worked out.
I for a long time, I really didn't think it could. And I was never really so much in love with the idea. I was very skeptical and tried to convince my mom that I'm okay, that I'm earning money. So I was always really looking at it from a different perspective, always all the angles, check the numbers. And the fun part was, besides that, I had a lot of fun. So I, for a long time, I couldn't believe that I get paid for what I'm doing.
Wow.
But it's actually, it's one of, I think one of the best moments in all that time was one of my first graphic recording job as at a retreat from young PhD students who had to present their work. Because during all this time doing biochemistry, doing physics, doing molecular biology and genetics, I was always wondering, what do I need all this for? Like, I learned how to read papers and to put my research into perspective. And at that very first retreat, I was standing at the wall and there was some young student talking about a reaction chain, the caspase wave something, and I was just like, this is exactly what I went to university for. I had all the knowledge I needed. I knew exactly where this was in my biochemistry folder, and that happened after that time more and more often. So for some weird way, it's exactly what was meant to happen. And I still have that one folder because that professor was really good and he loves visuals. So, and we keep in contact, and he thinks it's amazing that it fits so well, that where science communication, whenever that wasn't a thing, it was actually popping up around this time, 2016 to 17 in my bubble. I was there by accident and I just took it, and I was somehow I was in this bubble and did exactly the right thing.
Or maybe you were supposed to be there. Could think of it that way too. Interesting. All these opportunities sort of happened. You certainly could have gone and worked for a pharmaceutical, or, you know, if things had lined up right, you might be teaching in university and never had done this. So it's pretty interesting the way things work out and the way things work in your life. So it's really great to hear that story. It makes me really curious now. Obviously, you're a voice for scientists, either as students or professionals, or companies who are talking about scientific content to represent it in a visual way, which is so valuable, right? It's part of storytelling that the way we understand is through storytelling and visuals. They're the oldest things in our culture, right? So it makes sense that those are ways that we interpret and make sense of things. So two questions that I have. One was, so you're pretty accomplished in doing this. Are there other scientific people who are interested in learning how to visualize? Like, are there some that come in and have this visualization skill? They might have come in and said, well, I'm not using that anymore. I'm a scientist now. And maybe you awakened something in them that said, oh, you mean I can do visualization. Maybe it's not to the level, because you were focused on that, but it's at a level enough where they could explain their ideas. And are they learning from you and then applying it in their work? So in other words, are you replicating yourself to some degree? Maybe not exactly. So maybe that's my first question.
Actually, I did.
Yeah?
Well, about the first questions, yes, it happens really often. What I found out whenever I first did the first workshops like this, I picked up all these maybe lost souls like me, and all those kids that were good at, in drawing at school, that had these amazing art teachers where they could flourish. But they were actually taught that with doing something you like, and especially if it's art, if it's musical arts, you will not earn money with it. You cannot make a good living. And I think that's true. So because the way we take art for granted. Mm-hmm. But we never really understood that you can be good at more than one thing.
Yeah.
So I kind of met many, many students that were kind of like me. They said, you know, I love my research, and I love Photoshop, or I just love Illustrator. So much later they pick it up. And then there were some, and even one that I met, and I'm glad I met her, because she became my master student for over a year, and she's one of my best friends now, is that she had the same thing. She grew up with a family that really let her draw, that taught her, and she still picked up the scientific line of studying. And I see that the interest is so big, and they're so happy because for some reason, guess what? They love to draw their research. It's exactly what enables them to do even better presentation, better posters to help. And most of them really then they go to their superiors or their PIs and just like, can we do a workshop? We probably have money for that. Can we do that? Can we invite her?
Nice.
And it happened on a regular basis. And one of the centers is around Heidelberg. I was there very often. Mm-hmm. And I have many young students there who still keep in contact. Even a few days ago, I had one from the Charité, and she's married now. And her husband wrote me over LinkedIn, and he said, you know, I'm married to this young woman, and that was her former name. And she was one of your students, and we saw you last week in the graphic recording you did live close to where we live. And that's amazing that for some reason this just drawing left a mark that really they remember, and that it's a reason for them to just write me, even if there was nothing to say than just hi.
Yeah.
And many get inspired, they take it with them. And I'm not even afraid to like making little copies of myself, because for many this job, of course, they understand it's more than just drawing, illustrating. It's a different kind of work. It's a very lonely work, and you have to mind that or not to mind that. And I show them. And what is the most fun for me, it's to see how it is evolving, because they learn so much, and they learn that now they can incorporate it into their job. They can stay in science and deal with science communication at their institute. So it's actually fun having more and more people in science or as scientific illustrators, because this whole field almost died out in Germany because we didn't cherish it. It has some historical reasons. So there's still room for that. You just have to start right. And I have many people, at least maybe 5 to 10 a year, that just want to talk to me over the phone because they think of going that way. And then I'm kind of loading them up and telling them that's the deal. That's what it looks like. Yeah. So if you want to be successful, it's like a little mentoring. And I'm just telling them, you know, let's just talk for an hour. And then you can decide. And that's really, really fun, because with most of them, I'm still in contact and I see how they're building up their careers, or maybe getting out of science, maybe getting even more into science and now drawing. It's fun.
Wow. So you're sort of building like a, I would hesitate to call it a sub-community, but just another branch of the community, sketchnoting community, visualization community, specifically on science, which has its own demands and requirements and culture and all those things that you have to fit into, right? It's different than other places. And that leads me to my second question around this was, so I remember talking with Rob DeMia, who's also a friend with Katrina Theisbrohl, both physicists. And I learned that physicists have a really tight connection with visualization, like it's almost part of the way they think and work, right? So it was a natural ally. But the thing that I remember Rob telling me when I interviewed him many years ago was he took the concepts from the book, but he had to modify them for his purpose, because what he was doing is he was leading an installation, NIST in the U.S., which is this standards body organization, right? And he did one section. Well, he had the advantage of all these amazing scientists were coming right to him and presenting these amazing talks. And he had access to all of them. He didn't have to go anywhere. And he wanted to go take notes. And he had gotten into this sketchnoting visualization thing. And so he just showed up at one of the, I don't know which talk. And it was too much, right? Because he did not have, he was trying to expand his scientific knowledge beyond his narrow focus, right? You have to focus. So he went to something outside of it. And he said it was very difficult because there were all these understood notions and ideas that you had to come into the talk with to sort of rise up to the level where that speaker was. And that was really difficult. And so he modified his approach to including in his process this preparation phase where he would look up the person, read their research, understand the basic concepts. So when they came in, he was at least close to their level. So when they would come with something, assuming all these foundational pieces, he knew what they were, and then he could be right with them and be able to visualize. So he said that was the modification. I could have never known that, not being a scientist. Maybe the most difficult things I would go into were like development events, where I'm not a coder, but I understand enough conceptually that I can visualize what they're talking about, unless it gets really detailed. And most talks don't usually get that detailed. So that was maybe the most challenging talk that I might have encountered. But that was nowhere near like, you know, what he was dealing with. So it was necessary for another person to sort of take things in a different direction. So I do appreciate that. I suspect that's a challenge. I guess this is a very long question. Is that true in your space as well? Like, in order to do this, you sort of have to be in it. Like, the thing you said about Ben and Nadine, like, they sort of avoided this space because very quickly they would be underwater and not be able to keep up with the concepts. It almost requires this community that you're building to be able to keep up and make sense and stuff. Is that accurate?
That's accurate. Where I struggled first was in the first half year, because I could actually, from on top of my head, I could draw all of the icons in the Bicabla book, but they didn't fit because I didn't need a horse, I didn't need a frog, I didn't need an arrow, not even maybe a magnifying glass. I needed a microscope, a certain specific one, because we had like three different ones that I was using. Right. And the first struggle I had was as simple as it could be. I used antibodies from mice and from rats, and I needed an icon to diversify that, to just tell, okay, that's an antibody, I just had a code of numbers. So how do I draw a mouse different from a rat? Mm. That was my first big question. The other stuff I needed were cells, like different cell lines. So I did all these little icons. I tested out how to really always can tell there was an experiment with mice and that with rats. So that was really for weeks. I just kind of just had a sketchbook and I kind of crossed out everything that didn't fit until I was happy with the mice and the rats. So the visual language is a complete different one. Mm-hmm. And especially like in physics, if you have only formulas and equations, that's fun to draw. And the other thing is, I got into a research field, into conventions, where I was already safe, where I knew I studied all of this, I could get directly in. What I noticed, out of just curiosity, I always read these scientific abstracts. That's like the general deal. You always have to read them when you go to conventions, so they put you in. And if you have a basic scientific understanding of biology and genetics and medicine, you see where I'm getting, it's like it has to be really broad. Then you really get to the point and you're happy and you can always see, okay, that's my area of visual language that I need. But yes, you have to have cover that base. And there was always one really, I'll say, toxic sentence when I went to university, because for the nutritionist, they always tell you, you are a master in being general with all these sciences. you have the basic stuff covered, but you're not able doing some kind of nutritional scaling. You're not able to go people and teach how they could eat better. And even though you know everything, actually I know everything about every kind of sickness that is related to nutrition, but I can tell you how to eat healthy. That's really the one thing I did not never learn. I only That's learned the sick stuff.
Interesting.
And we have so much medicine during the time at the university, but we're not allowed to treat people because we're not medical doctors.
Right.
But the way all these studies are designed, all the subjects, is that we have such a broad basic language. It's actually perfect for being a graphic recorder in the scientific field. You had to do all the math. You had to do all this awesome and painful physics, and do all the biology and genetics and medicine. So we fit in so many subjects that it's for me really fun whenever I have a client who's doing some really new, amazing research. I'm just like, give me the papers. I don't need a briefing. Yeah. Just give me your papers. Give me the numbers, and I'm fitting in. So the curiosity of a scientist comes back into the game, and that's how I prepare. It's a lot of preparation, but it's fun because that way I kind of stay a bit up really.
Yeah.
To pace with all the new scientific stuff, and whenever that new vaccination came out with the mRNA molecules, I was just like, I had that in my books. That was still. The new technology for the future when I went to university, and I'm there to witness it, and I'm there that people start drawing it, communicating it. It's amazing.
So would you say that maybe then nutritionists specifically, or are there other scientific areas which would produce this type of thinker who is a generalist, maybe are the ideal candidate? Like I think that's what you're leaning to, that maybe other nutritionists are a natural fit if they have visualization skills. There maybe are some other spaces too that are similar, I guess. I don't know what they would be.
Yeah, I think all the natural sciences that get more specific now, the formal ones like the biologist and everyone just studying geography or geology, because what is right now, the Bachelor of Science in many universities is the same. So they all have the same lectures, and that's a perfect base doing stuff like this. If you see, you're not really getting anywhere. You need more, even though probably most of the things that I need in graphic recording to really speak in front of so many people, to have the ability to communicate in English fluently, was in my master's and in my PhD. But still, if you keep up early with other workshops, like I was always looking into every other class that I could while at the university. I did everything not science related. To really figure out, is there has to be something. Something is out there that it's not science, and that's my thing. And that's how I found even sketchnoting and illustration. So that's what I always tell my students, is if there's something that you're interested in, something that kind of triggers you to learn something new, and it's fun for you, do that. Because everything I did on the side, just out of interest, at some point in my life, added something so valuable that I could use it because I did it with heart. And that's how all this came together. I did just put all the pieces that were on the way that I took with me, all the memories, into one, and decided to build a whole new career out of it that no one has heard of before, that you cannot really study, that you can only get there by really studying on your own and then figuring it out. By building on a really, really solid scientific career and on studies, which was not possible in the past. It's now a time where a lot of people just change careers, and it's that possibility for so many others, and they're needed. I mean, I'm really stuffed with work, so there's a lot.
There's a question that pops in my head when you talk about all this, and you mentioned that this general science program is ideal for this type. Do you think it makes sense that maybe you approach university, maybe you start with one, and say, hey, look, I do this thing, you lay out what it is. What if in the final year that these students are wrapping up, we offer an elective for scientific visualization, I don't know, whatever you call it, right? So that you, now it's integrated into the curriculum, and that those who are drawn to it could electively choose to take it. And then you start identifying those people, you train them all the things you've learned. So now they have a leg up when they can either choose to take it and move to the next level, or maybe they become like you. Like, is that something, would that work? And then I guess the other question, is it even possible in the educational system you're in?
Right now, I'm already offering it to my university. It's like, oh, I'm sometimes jumping in front of them and telling them, you know, if there's ever like a professorship that you would like to kind of found with science communication, I'm there. I have almost everything they would need to get me, just put me on this chair. Mm-hmm. That's where the PhD comes in very handy. Mm-hmm. And even the teaching experience. And I said, you know, I kind of have already mapped out the whole lecture. If there's a possibility, a chance that you can like create this position, I would be there. Right now, it's a problem of the system. Like, yeah. you cannot from one day to the other make just a position pop up and make all the other professors mad that are waiting for their positions for years. Right. And it's always a problem of, they don't know where to put me. They always want to put me with the teachers.
Yeah, and I'm just like, attached to?
No. This is nothing for education of little children. I want to be where really the scientists are. I'm already in the PhD program of my university and at other mm-hmm. universities that invite me. And slowly the system is changing, but it's a structural issue. And I hope I'll be there to really see it. And I told them, I'm there if you have a position. I would love to teach really young scientists and even do it for more than one faculty. Mm-hmm. Because they see the interest is there. And even telling my students and my contacts that I have at the university, put me in whenever you want to. If you want to have just a lecture, even if it's only for one semester, I'm coming. If you can build up your own curriculum, I'll be there. You have my contact data. The university even tries to put me in for different formats as much as they can. But yet, everything has to be like put into a certain point system. And in the system of how to get these points, there is like, there's no option yet for, there is this crazy woman who wants to draw with scientists. But we get there.
Where do we put that? Yeah. Interesting. So it's a long, long term.
Yeah. But the president of the university, he already knows me after a few years. And he actually thinks he's an IT guy. I think he knows what I'm doing, but I saw once his reaction to one of my biggest recording that I ever did. It was like, I think almost 10 meters on a wall.
Wow.
And it was in Boston. And he was just like, what can this thing do?
Yeah.
So it's really, people have to see it and have to see the method work. Mm-hmm. And we got pretty far and we will get further.
Yeah, especially scientists, right? They want to see the process, not only once, but repeatable, right? You have to repeat that process. So, and I think you're doing that work, right? Maybe it turns out that you make, you know, right near the end of this long journey, you convince someone, now you make a position that someone else, you can now prepare for the next person.
I'm traveling the world until then, collecting ideas and new methods. Because I know if that ever works out with the position at the university, I won't be really traveling that much and won't be able to be see you guys. So, and buy pens in foreign countries. So
enjoy it while you have it, right?
Right.
Well, this is really fascinating. We talked, just before we began, and this is around real practical things. So I typically ask, what are some things you're excited about that you're doing now? I would love for you to talk about this thing we talked about with the elderly and Zoom and how your this real basic, simple teaching can have an impact. Tell us that story.
I am in the fortunate situation that I share a hobby with my mother. We do paper folding. So since I'm a little girl, we fold paper. It started out with origami stars as for, I think, every kid in Germany. we just start out with paper stars, and if we catch on to it, it becomes boxes and animals and kusudamas. It's like platonic shapes. You can do a lot of math with it. So, but and there is this underground community worldwide with origami enthusiasts, and we connect over international conventions that what I travel for, and especially for the European countries. There's a certain age difference in who's folding. Mm. The kids don't stay long with it. Then everyone who has kids kind of drops out for a while because they have to take care of the kids. Mm-hmm. And then around the age of maybe 40, they start back to join. And there's this really amazing crowd of elderly people in Germany, mostly women, that love to handcraft and to fold, really with their grandkids. So they pass it on. Mm. And they're really creative, and they love the German convention, and they sometimes travel. Even my mom accompanies me in some of the conventions, so I'm always her translator. That's my job then. And it's really fun doing that with her. But then the pandemic hit, and we couldn't meet because they were the vulnerable group, so we had to shut down everything. And they couldn't even meet locally because all of them were elderly.
Right.
So what happened, they were writing to us, because I'm actually in the international and in the German organization for origami and paper folding. So we were just like on the board, what do we do? I said, well, we just get a Zoom account. We teach them Zoom. And we were afraid that they wouldn't take on or pick it up. And the most amazing thing happened, I did like scheduled meetings, because we wrote all of them by paper, really an official letter. We have something called a Zoom account, and we did like an article in our magazine where everything was drawn out how you do this. And we had technical checkup dates before the actual event, and really every night I sat there and they were trying to log in. Some called me on the phone. And I was prepared for everything, for old computers, for not working phones. And what I did as a visual practitioner, I drew out these little black cards, since Zoom is black in the background. And with like some metallic markers and white markers, I redrew the microphone, the camera. And I did like little boards where I said, can you see me? Can you hear me? And I illustrated everything. Because sometimes I could see them, they could see me or not. Mm-hmm. And we got there, and they picked up so fast with Zoom. Mm. So they were digitized faster than some of the school kids. Mm. Most fun thing was I saw all the technical equipment. Most of them, since they were elderly, the husband usually had a computer in their home. So it was always just like, okay, I'm online. Honey, you can go now. I'm going fully. I have fun. I don't need you. And they were all like, they were shushed out, and they went out of their offices. All these German elderly men had to camp out in the living room because the wife was always occupying the computer now just to do Zoom, because she was able to. They couldn't. Yeah. And they got out all the equipment they have. And some even said, you know, it's okay. I saw you, but I'm taking off the camera because for the meeting, I only need to see you folding, right? Mm. Yes. Okay. Then I know everything. And some even, before a new meeting, they wanted to learn more. So they were just like, yeah, I know how Zoom works. I just wanted to see if you're there. And I have this one question, because my nephew couldn't answer me that. How does that button work? And there was, how does this with the breakout sessions? And I said, you need an update. But they really overcame all these issues because they wanted to fold. So they needed to learn this new star from some folder or this new box. And they were like, sometimes like little kids, because they connect with international folders where they have the book from, and they were holding it in the camera. And I even had like sessions where they checked out, okay, no, I cannot wear the sweater in Zoom, the lightning, that doesn't fit. You don't usually see the paper if I'm holding it up. That doesn't go. Hang on, I'm changing, and then they're coming back. So they really, it was so much fun, and they lost, of course, just the fear of being online. And it's amazing. Then they always, sometimes even they wrote afterwards, this was so nice. And now I can even chat with my niece and my daughter.
I know, they're not skilled.
They were really surprised. Yes, yeah. It was fun. It's really rewarding.
So I was going to ask, do you think the little cards that you made accelerated their learning? Do you get a pretty good sense that that helped them a lot?
Yes, because if you're not used to it, you only use one channel of information.
Yeah.
So even usually they couldn't hear me, so they called on the phone, and I was just like, look for this icon. And it was really like Pictionary for some reason, where they think, okay, where is this? I can see that. And I saw them looking for the icons. Mm. And it really helped, because you never knew, can they see me or can they just hear me? And later on, you even saw them sometimes using own cards or word cards. So it was just like, okay, I'm training them here now to maybe shut up, but to listen to something that's happened on a video. Because when they're folding, they didn't recognize that the paper was so loud that they're crumbling. So all these side effects were accounted for.
Mm. It seems like a really good opportunity to take that concept and apply it in different places, right? What thing could you do cards with to train?
The cards, these endless cards that I did in a sketch note, actually meeting, came from origami or went back and forth. And what I tried out there is we always, when we do workshops, since you don't have to see the folder, you just have to see the hands. And we work a lot with words and visualization because we mark our paper where you have to fold it if the light is not that good.
Right.
And what we do sometimes is we want to hold things in the camera, communicate. Since you don't see the person talking, I started out designing those little sheets under my camera, under my documentary camera, to talk to them or maybe do a countdown. So I had like a post-it stack and then I wrote 10, took it away, 9, took it away, 8. So I really start playing with this to keep people interested and in front of the camera. And there's a lot more potential to even do craftings, to show little things that they usually cannot see while being in Zoom. And pens and paper work well even on this remote setting.
That's really interesting that this old, really old technology married with a new technology makes it better. I think that creative thinking is the valuable part, right? That how can you, when you listen to this interview, what in your life can you take a simple, boring thing, sticky notes and a pen, and make it useful in a new way? So be encouraged by that. So lately, because the pandemic doesn't seem to want to end, maybe this summer will be the summer, I don't know. I ask people, what is the thing that they did or they do to help them deal with like something being closed or lockdown or whatever disruption? Are there some hobbies or activities that you like to do to kind of keep yourself sane?
Well, I'm pretty happy with collecting pens and ordering them.
Yeah.
But during the first lockdown in December, I was very fortunate because I had a client who said, you know, we have this big gardening space and nobody is allowed to come because our season is usually later. Mm. But we have these old walls and these just signs put up, and they have to be kind of approved by law by the EFSA. It was on nutritional stuff. Mm. And he said, you know, the guy that was painting them once, he's not alive anymore. Mm. But they need to be updated. So I kind of did like my own sign painting over the whole summer. I went out and I was allowed to draw on walls. It was nice because nobody really could keep me off my work. I was outside. I guess I never got that much sun in the summer. And I was allowed to play with walls and with a lot of paint that I never did before. I was allowed to ask graffiti artists because nobody could tell me what to use on the walls, so the weather resistant. And it was really just drawing outside because that was permitted. We even did urban sketching. So we try to make the best of the situation and really focused on something that was possible. And even my client, they just picked up the phone, made an Instagram story of that. They were very happy because we'll be the only one at this garden redoing everything. And sometimes if there were tourists, they would of course ask us. So actually in this time, even indoors, I used to focus on certain things. I even do little workshops. I pick up an old book of a comic artist and I start imitating the style. Because for some reason I have to see I did something on that day. And then I look through a sketchbook and it kind of replays all the memories or associations with it. So I kind of pick my own projects.
So you just kind of keep projects moving. Yeah, that sounds good.
Yeah. Even though if there's no client or no idea, I mean, I think everyone that's some kind of has an artistic talent, bit artsy, has these books that they buy that are in the shelf, that are dying there, that are getting dusty. Yeah. So I would say read Marie Kondo and then in parallel draw something so to get them out, because I figured I cannot buy new books if I'm not sorting some out, and I can only sort them out by going through them and
reading them.
Looking at other artist stuff. You kind of learn how they think, and it's really inspiring. You have some new input, even if you cannot maybe talk to family or friends, but I kind of made my own bubble. I'm happy with it, but I don't need as many people around. So that's maybe that solution for that part.
Well, you can only speak to your experience, so that's okay.
This episode of the Sketchnote Army podcast is brought to you by Concepts, an infinite canvas sketching app built for tablets with a stylus, like the iPad Pro, Microsoft Surface, and Samsung Galaxy Tab. Concepts' infinite canvas lets you spread out and sketch in any direction. Everything you draw in Concepts is a flexible vector, so you can move your notes around the canvas or change their color, tool, or size with a simple gesture. Search Concepts in your favorite app store for infinite, flexible sketching.
So let's switch over to tools. This is a fun area. We'll start with analog first and digital. So paper, pens, pencils, any of that kind of stuff, and then whatever digital tools that you use.
Yeah, actually one of them, I even always have it on my desk. I have many of them. The Faber-Castell has, of course, many amazing pens. And there is one that I love for years now. It's a broad pen. It's a broad pen 1554. It exists like in 8 colors, and it has this amazing unspeakable color of erythian blue. So it's really hard for Germans to say that word, even if it's in the German kind of way, whatever this color is. I have no clue. I cannot pronounce it in German. I can barely pronounce it in English. And it's some kind of grayish blue. It's a permanent ink. It's a 0.8 just nib, and it's amazing for signing. I love it because I don't like the usually ballpoint pen and this bright blue, so it's perfect. And I love to sketch with it. I love to do sketch notes with it all over. And then of course these Tombow Fudenosuke, the brush pen, but the hard one, I never get out of them. I always restack them even in my office now. Because without this pen, I cannot live it anymore. It's not possible. there always has to be at least 2 in my apartment, and there are 20 in the office for workshops, because people always ask me for these. And I came in love with the German pen brand that I didn't know for a long time. It's the Molotov markers.
Yep, I love
Molotov has, they have like a new pen. It's a whole line. It's chrome, liquid chrome, and it feels like you're drawing with liquid aluminum foil.
Really,
it's really so shiny. It reflects. It works on every dark surface, even on light ones, and you really have the imagination that there's aluminum foil, like pure silver, if you're maybe even quicksilver coming out of your pen, and they're awesome. So those are really the. Yeah, the one that I always have around. And so, and then of course, from digital tools, as I draw most of the time with Procreate, but I'm slowly in need always for vector graphics, and I'm fine with the Affinity Designer. I mean, the projects are not supposed to be so big, but I have 2 books out now just from the origami part, and I illustrated 2 complete origami books on very technical drawings. And the first one, I still did everything in Procreate. And I always need those dotted lines or maybe dot line, and back then I didn't know how to design the brushes. So that was fun, erasing everything from these lines to make them look the way they're supposed to. And for the second book, I really taught myself Affinity Designer. So I'm happy with those two. Those are the ones that I'm always referring to. And if I have to, of course, then I switch to Photoshop and Illustrator. But on the iPad, it's those two. But I noticed that if I can leave it aside, I still love the feedback of the paper. So if I can do analog drawing, always for sketchbooks, I love character design, but I'm not happy enough yet with the results. But I love to just try it out, grab a soft pencil or colored pencil and try out. And later on, it's these fine liners that I just love. Of course, I have like a bunch of pens everywhere.
Oh, yeah, every of course.
I count them every once in a while, but I think most pens I have are black fine liners.
Yeah, yeah. So you didn't mention in the analog gum, do you have a preference for a paper or notebooks that you like to use? You mentioned that someone wanted to buy your notebooks, right? Do you just use a standard notebook off the shelf or?
Yeah, I like exploring. At the beginning, I love the ones from Leuchtturm, but the paper is too thin with the dotted grid. Yeah. If I really wanna try out pens and acrylic markers, now I'm switching mostly to the art books from Moleskine and Leuchtturm. It's more about the thickness of the paper. It has to have at least 100 grams, but I really don't mind. I think it's fun reusing them. So I rather like exploring the brand than always choosing the same.
I know Leuchtturm has just released a 120 gram, which I'm using in my bullet journal from the bullet journal. Writer has done a partnership with them using the 120 gram books, and the paper seems pretty nice.
Yeah, so. I saw that.
There's lots of options. It seems like there's always something new. That's really great.
What I'm doing lately, I'm switching quite often for projects.
Oh, okay.
So I pick these small ones, these thin ones from Moleskine, the art books, and sometimes I sketchnote a whole book, and I want to have this book in one sketchnote, in one sketchbook, and that's what I'm switched now over that last half year to always buy the thin ones. So to have it categorized, but I think it's still fun switching brands. So,
And that would be the ones that are stapled on the edge, right?
Not always.
Oh, really? Sometimes really your soft cover.
Yeah. Okay. I like the soft cover better. It's just more fun.
Is it something like 60 pages, probably, or something half the size of a normal, or maybe a third? Yeah. Interesting. That's an interesting idea to have a book per book, like a 1-to-1 ratio. Right. Where then they maybe travel together. Maybe they stay together on the bookshelf, right?
So when you pull out the thing. Yeah. I always discover them on my work trips, the few that I had. I feel like always a bloodhound in a new city. I define cities by the fact how fast I find myself a shop for pens. So actually cities get categorized by this if I have to go back to them. there are some really... like one trip, I was in the city out of the train station for 10 minutes and I found the three best shops in town. That's when I went to the client after that, but I'm just trying to hit them right away.
Priorities.
And if I can find one, then the city is no good to visit again. So they find me somehow. It's weird. It always happens.
Interesting. That's funny. Well, let's shift into tips now. We ask this on each episode, and the way I frame it is we have a listener who's listening, or listeners. They love visualization, however they express that. Maybe they feel like they've hit a plateau and they just need a little encouragement to begin growing again. What would be three things you would tell that listener?
I would be telling them, because I hit that point every once in a while too. That's one reason why I didn't study art, because I thought, I'm not getting any further, not getting better. What I didn't know back then. What helps me a lot is copy other artists. So I really buy a whole book of one that the style I like. And if there's not a program like this, or if they don't have a book like that, really I start copying to understand their lines, their way of thinking. And usually that way I get in contact with them and can ask them. They're usually nice. They like that. If that's not something, because it works well for comic styles and some others, Then I have this some kind of French book line. I can give you the link later. It's I found it on accident, and it's a really fun book for visual experiments. Like, they give you two images, like a banana and a shoelace, and you're supposed to match them. So you're making imaginary images of something that doesn't exist, but they always look so funny. They have these exercises in these books. So, and it's the only brand that I know so far that does that, and does it's really fun. And another thing, which is more related to drawing, and not to writing, is I really can calm down by rewriting poems. I'm copying them, actually. So I'm cleaning out my handwriting quite often in a year, and I have this wonderful author. He's by chance, actually, he's a biochemist, but he's a great poet, and he has this fun way of writing poems. So whenever I need lettering practice, I chose his poems and just write on big paper on the walls. And my niece loves it because the poems are funny and she understands them. And I notice as a side effect that I really can calm down. I have other ideas with that. I'm trying new pens, and it somehow I can really just, it slows me down. That's actually the effect, and it brings great creativity. It's just a nice input by doing something, not really drawing, but just by writing. And if the pen goes dry, if it breaks, it's okay. Then it did its job, and I know exactly how long I could draw with it. And I have these wonderful walls just of handwriting. It's fun.
Well, that's really great. Copying, I think, is a huge thing. I think we in the West sort of discount it. I've read some articles that in Asian culture, specifically Japanese culture, it's very popular to copy. That's a common way to learn. I really like it because you tend to deconstruct, I think, what you were saying. You're deconstructing how that person thinks and then reformatting it in the way that you can use it. So naturally speaking, as hard as you try to copy them, it's always going to have your own style attached to it. So there's a way to make it more your style, which is, I think, a really great way to go. That's the way I think of what I realize when I look at layouts. I look at other people's layouts and I deconstruct why they work and what were the conditions in which they use that technique and why did it work. So if you go deep enough into that, you have almost like modules or components. In this situation, these couple of things work really well for that context, so I'll use that. Rather than, I think a lot of times you can get do a layout and you sort of get locked into it, and then the speaker changes or something breaks down, and suddenly your structure doesn't work anymore because it's so rigid. Yeah. So thinking about it modularly can often help. So that's really great. That's a really encouraging tip.
And sometimes after it's sunk in, after weeks or months, there will be that one moment where you need it. I noticed that with the drawing hands. Like, I took the class from Nadine that she put out, and there were some positions, they just don't work for me. I can't do it. But then there's this once in recording, and in my mind, I have really the pieces of the puzzle that fit together, and I get there faster. And sometimes on the wall, I'm just like, wow, that for some reason that worked. My mind and my muscles didn't know how to do it, even though I couldn't remember what it was in there. So you incorporate it into your style, into your lines. And that's the fun part about sketchnoting, about drawing. If you don't practice, you don't get better. But most of the time, it doesn't feel like practice. No matter what you do, you always grow. So you don't have, it's not like hard training, not like learning something by heart. You're just doing it because you're using the tool, and your mind and your body keeps on growing on and really manifests the technique. Mm-hmm. And that's amazing. It kind of goes like underground, and still something is happening there. It's amazing.
It's like planting a seed. You're sort of living into it, right?
Yep.
Cool. This is really great. So Francesca, tell us, how can we find you? Do you have a website? And in which socials can you give us some good places where you're active that we can go and see the work you're doing and get in contact with you?
Yeah, I have a website. due to having this process by being supported by the university, you always have to think of some kind of fancy name. So mine was scivisto.com. It's for scientific visualization tools. And nobody can really say it in German. It's kind of hard. But they always think I'm skiing, so most of them make Skivisto out of it, which is still fun. but it works. And under Scivisto, you find me on Twitter. On Instagram, you find me actually under Francisca V or W, actually, Schwartz. And on LinkedIn and Xing, I'm there too as a science communicator. It's fun how the different communities interlink.
Yeah, crazy.
Yeah, but you can actually find me in the internet on Instagram and on Twitter and LinkedIn and Xing. And that's barely anything I can handle. There's a Facebook page, but...
that's
a lot
already.
Oh, boy.
That's a lot already. Can't do too much.
Right. I'm there, but I'm not really using it. So, but I see the messages usually like half a year later.
So have patience if you message there.
Yeah. Usually it's a birthday something, so it's okay. Whenever you actually see someone has birthday, that's what Facebook is for many people.
Yeah,
but,
exactly.
But yeah, most of the time I'm actually on Instagram. That's the platform currently on. Yeah.
Okay. And of course, with every show, for the video and for the audio, we'll have links to all this stuff in the show notes so you can click on them and find them. So thanks so much, Francisca, for being on the show and being willing to come and talk with us and share your perspective and your experience. It's really fun to hear all the stuff you're doing. I'm really surprised myself and encouraged, and I just love the impact you're having on our community. Thank you for everything you've done, for being there for others and being so encouraging. I really appreciate all that you've done for our community and for me.
Thanks for having me. Who thought that what could come from this little black book that was there when I was looking it up, and I remember seeing you the first time at a sketch note bar camp, and it was just like, oh boy, okay. Okay. And then even in France, in Paris, you mentioned me while on stage, you know, that I was like sinking in into my chair, and it's like, he's talking about me. What? Okay, cool. That was amazing. It's a great community. I met so many nice people thanks to you, to what you do. So,
well, thank you. And it's always a community effort, right? It's all of us. So I can't take all the credit. I can only take my proportion. There's so many other people involved. And I think it draws people like us who, you know, are encouraging and sharing and all those things. So congrats to the community in general, because we keep it going. So thank you for all you who listen and participate. So for everyone, this is another episode of the Sketchnote Army podcast, whether you're watching or listening. Until the next episode, talk to you soon.
The Sketchnote Army podcast was created by me, Mike Rohde, and brought to you by Rohde Design Studios. It's produced and edited by Alec Polianis of Amp Creative Studios. The theme music was created by John Schiedemeyer. To support the creation of this show, I invite you to buy one of my books, the Sketchnote Handbook or the Sketchnote Workbook. You can find the books on Amazon or go to peachpit.com and use the code RODY40 for 40% off. Please share this podcast with other visual thinking friends and be sure to leave a nice rating on iTunes or your favorite podcast listening app so others can find the show.